State Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for January the 27th, 2019, the last Sunday of January. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, it's great to be back.
Welcome back.
Good to have you back.
It's good to be back. I know you here in studio would rather have Amanda Winicky.
I wasn't going to say anything,
I get that. You know, here I am, loopy, recovering from surgery. I love the attitude.
That would have been a good show, Loopy and surgery, you know?
Well, actually, that sums up everything every Sunday morning.
That's why I have my buddy Brian Bernadoni in here. He's playing second chair for me today.
And I'm no Amanda Winicky either.
No, you're not. But I can't thank Amanda enough for stepping in last Sunday while I was recuperating. And so now I have a new bionic right shoulder. And I have to tell you, the pain isn't as bad as the pain was from my fractured shoulder previously. I want to thank all the folks at Midwest Orthopedic at Rush, including Dr. Gregory Nicholson, for their fine work. Dr. Nicholson, just a total class expert. He said he had a lot of work to do, but he got it done. And while there's plenty of rehab that's on the horizon, it does feel better already, except for trying to sleep. And that's been a little tough. And that will explain the loopiness, because it's not about pain meds, okay? I'm not doing those other than a little extra strength Tylenol.
But we have coffee on the way.
We have coffee. There you go. That can alleviate some pain this morning. But
it'll also warm you up.
Well, I will tell you, I guess if you were going to be kind of laid up and out of action, last week and this coming week are the best 2 weeks to do it. Well, I mean, we're just the scariness of that weather forecast is the below zero temps on Wednesday are just... I've talked to my Aunt Jo up in Askove, and they've had a couple of days of 12 below highs.
Yeah.
And if somebody says, well, they're used to it up there, well, I got to tell you, no one's used to it.
No. Okay. No. What's more, Rick, you mentioned Wednesday, the high air temperature predicted to be something around minus 10. But strong northwest winds give us wind chills of 40 to 50 below.
Yeah. That's
so. Yeah, no one has ever adjusted to this.
No. So I mean, I know, folks, you're going to keep hearing a lot about weather, including, you know, this later this evening. I think around 6 o'clock, I guess, is when the snow is supposed to start.
That's
falling.
When the winter weather advisory begins. Where we have a wind chill advisory right now.
Yeah.
So the winter weather advisory, 6 o'clock tonight until 6 o'clock Monday evening. So, 24-hour stretch there of a wind chill, a winter weather advisory.
Well, it's January, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we knew we were going to get this at some point, and so we just muscle through it. I mean, I look at, you know, the predicted highs for next weekend are back in the 30s, so there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Going to be a long tunnel.
It is. So yeah, get some logs for the fireplace and hunker down. But we'll make through this. We'll survive.
Yep, we have before. We will again.
Absolutely.
Interesting to look at the frozen Chicago River, though.
It is. Yes, the view of the river over the Skyline Studio here, the Allstate Skyline Studio, is pretty amazing. Someone tweeted out a picture of saying you know when it's cold in Chicago when you see the steam rising from the river.
That's right.
And that's absolutely the truth.
Yeah, Friday it went from flowing to steaming to freezing all in like 6 hours.
That could also describe my mood on some days, you know? It's
flowing, steaming, freezing.
Yes, exactly.
Especially now with one arm out of action.
Yes, yes. Well, and I have to tell you, one, thank you all for expressing concern and your thoughts and best wishes. And got a lot of texts and a lot of notes on Facebook and Twitter and Doc Emmerich checking in. To see how I was doing, and I have to admit, I couldn't stay up for the entire game last night.
He just does that as a passing word. Doc Emmerich, you know, I mean, he's a legend.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, trust me, it's great. It's great to have a guy like that on your side. But I was watching, I watched about maybe a half of the NHL All-Star game, mm-hmm. and let's face it, the All-Star game isn't really an All-Star game.
No, it's, there's no defense. And it, you know, now with the 3-on-3, the way they have it, it's kind of like the overtime and the regulation of NHL. And, you know, there's some fancy passing, there's some nice shots, but it's, you know, it's kind of an exhibition of some of these guys' skills. And to me, speaking of skills, I think the skills competition the night before is better than the game.
Yes, yes, yes. And but I will tell you, I felt bad for Doc Emmerich because, I mean, let's face it, the skating is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I swear he was going hoarse by the end of the first game, just with all of the scores that were going on.
Yeah, there's no stoppages.
No.
Well, I think we missed the. I mean, if you saw the footage of that female Olympian, I mean, her speed skating skills were astounding. It's a great thing to see the NHL actually add women into this competition because it. I think women are coming into the game in a big way as fans and clearly as players.
Well,
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I mean, Olympic women's hockey is fantastic.
Yeah, especially after winning a gold medal. Kendall Coyne was the skater, and she finished, I think, at 14.6, and they showed the video of it yesterday during the NHL All-Star game, and she was flying.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, oh, my God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, my shoulder was wincing because I was figuring she could put me into the boards real easy.
Oh, man.
You know? But no, it just, I mean, it's fun to watch, but it's kind of like, you know, the Pro Bowl football.
Which is today, and there's a lot of Bears in it, but that's still, it's still a tough watch, the Pro Bowl.
Well, I think I watched some of the Illinois-Maryland game, a rare Illinois Illini victory mm-hmm. over a ranked team, first time since, I guess, March of 2016 that they beat a ranked team. And
Away. I think that's the correlation. It's the first time they beat them away. I think they beat them at Madison Square Garden. So that's a big deal.
That's a nice forum.
To win on the road like that.
But one of the announcers there was talking about the defense and said that you're seeing more defense in this game than you're going to see in the Pro Bowl on
Sunday. That's a good point.
And, yeah, absolutely. But I will tell you, it's been kind of weird being at home because I don't, you know, I don't watch a lot of TV normally, and when I do, it's sports. And
no Sven Gulli?
I watched Sven Gulli, yes, and I even watched the yesterday morning, the early Daughter of Dracula.
Fantastic film.
Absolutely. One of the classics. But it's, you really get, you know, especially as someone, you know, who's recovering from surgery, wow, is pharma everywhere. I mean, all of the ads for prescriptions and everything, and it's almost like if you're not sick, it'll make you sick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is so much money involved in that stuff. It's that trial lawyers, cable TV, and the car company.
Kind of makes you miss Harry Schmirler, your singing Ford dealer,
yes,
doesn't
indeed.
It? Rockabye, your baby.
Or Burt Wyman.
Hey, you get this beautiful 1977 Cutlass Super Sport with a power windows, power brakes, AM, FM stereo. Burt Wyman, price of $17.99.
Don't forget Long Chevrolet.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Extra, extra.
Read all about it.
And the Landau roof.
Oh, yes, man.
Those are, I mean, it does take your breath away, just where advertising has gone to and that kind of thing. And
well, then you get the inexplicable political campaign commercial sometimes in the middle of stuff. I mean, there's some interesting buys going on when you start looking at it. Watching Sven Gulli last night, Jerry Joyce did two biopics.
Well, and those are his first ads coming out. Bill Daly ads everywhere.
Chico as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's starting to, it depends on the swings, though. I mean, it'll be interesting for those political science majors over at the University of Chicago or Illinois State or places like that to take a look at where those ad buys are and what the micro-targeting of demographics actually looked like.
Now, I forgot the hotel bell. So you got one bell for Sven Gulli. You get another one for Illinois State.
Oh.
It's always great to have Brian here. And now, let's not jump too far ahead here, because we're going to spend, after the 7:30 news, we're going to cover a lot of ground. And we're going to talk about the mayor's race, some of the developments that have gone on there. It's been a pretty interesting time to watch here. And as I always say about political campaigns, sometimes the biggest developments, oftentimes the biggest developments in a campaign are ones beyond the candidate's control.
One of the things that's not political but is very realistic is when you're driving around downtown, especially first thing in the morning, and I see Rick sometimes very early in the morning downtown, homelessness still is an issue in this town. There's no doubt about it. But on days like today, when it's that cold, thankful there are places like Salvation Army and other places that are out there doing the work to try and get these folks into shelters, because the temperatures are out of this world. And when you're on Lower Wacker or Lower Michigan, it's a profound thing. It's a profound thing to see in this city. It really is. And folks who can help, I encourage you to do so.
I absolutely wholeheartedly agree. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Just a reminder that Dave's here in the newsroom to keep us up to date on all the happenings in the world. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Sammy is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200, which is our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, and we're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is back in today to see how his patient is doing. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Time to launch our weekly spin through national politics. And of course, on Friday, the partial shutdown of the federal government ended after 35 days. President Trump folded, agreed to a short-term 3-week funding measure, didn't get any money that he demanded for his wall. And you almost have to think that news of flight curtailments in the Northeast due to problems staffing traffic control towers, including LaGuardia, made Trump's losing hand even more precarious. So we have until February 15th, but will anything change? Democrats continue to remain unified against the $5.7 billion that the president wants for his wall. But Trump defiantly wants the wall. Here's what he said on Friday.
So let me be very clear. We really have no choice but to build a powerful wall or steel barrier. If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency. We will have great security.
So the national emergency option remains for Trump, but how much damage has occurred so far? Democrats blasted Trump for using federal workers as hostages. Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, took a victory lap.
The president has agreed to our request to open the government and then debate border security, which is great news for 800,000 federal workers and millions of Americans who depend on government services. As Democrats have said all along, the solution to this impasse was separate funding for the government and then go over our disagreements from border security. Separate the funding of government from the discussion on border security, and that's what we got. And Democrats in the Senate and in the House were united behind this position throughout the shutdown, and ultimately this agreement endorses our position.
So we have Democrats in control of the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a major factor in how the House-Senate conference works on funding for Homeland Security. Here's what she had to say.
It is very clear that we all understand the importance of securing our borders, and we have some very good ideas on how to do that, and that will be part of the discussion as we go forward. House Democrats look forward to working in a bipartisan, bicameral way to pass all of the bills to open government as we proceed into the conference discussion. Now, I'm an appropriator, and I was forged in that culture, and I know, left to their own devices, that the appropriators bicamerally and bipartisanly can come to conclusion. Again, sometimes it comes to the four principles of the leaders of the House and Senate to weigh in, and I think that we will have a very productive time in a short period of time to come to some conclusion. We're grateful, inspired by the courage and the determination of America's workers. They have shown during this crisis something such strong character. But nonetheless, they have to pay the bills when they come due, whether it's a rent check, paying their mortgage, their credit card bills, or a car payment. The list goes on. Some of them didn't even have gas money because they didn't have cash or any more line of or credit card ability to put gas in the car to go to work. It's really hard for some in the administration to understand how people live paycheck to paycheck and how marginal some of their existences are.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with my good friend Brian Bernadoni, the Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy at the Chicago Association of Realtors. We're going to talk about all things politics, from everything going on in the mayor's race all the way to what happened with the partial government shutdown and its net effects after 35 days. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll be speaking to Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park, Senator very big on Veterans Affairs issues. And, of course, we received news last week that after that deadly Legionnaires series of outbreaks at the Quincy Veterans Home, that Legionosis was discovered at the Mantino Veterans Home. So we'll talk to him about what the new incoming Pritzker administration's plans are for dealing with veterans care. And then after the 8:30 news, we'll be speaking to Kwame Raoul, the former Democratic state senator from Chicago, is the new attorney general for the state of Illinois. That's all up ahead.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, overlooking a very frozen Chicago River, but a beautiful, beautiful sunrise. And joining me here in studio is my good friend Brian Bernadoni, the Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy at the Chicago Association of Realtors. We closed out that last segment. Obviously, we're still talking about the end of the 35-day government shutdown. And Nancy Pelosi kind of remarked in that last cut about questioning people in the administration understanding the degree of how this affects regular people. And it's clear that some in the Trump administration appeared out of touch. That includes Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. Appearing on CNBC, Ross said he didn't understand federal workers having to go to things like food banks or having to drive Uber to make money.
The credit union should be making credit available to them. When you think about it, these are basically government-guaranteed loans because the government has committed these folks will get their back pay once this whole thing gets settled down. So there really is not a good excuse why there really should be a liquidity crisis. Now, true, the people might have to pay a little bit of interest, but the idea that it's paycheck or zero is not a really valid idea.
That is the Commerce Secretary of the United States of America, Wilbur Ross. Brian, I don't know what to say because, you know, that just feeds that idea that these people live on a different planet.
Well, you get when you look at a couple different things, and there's a whole bunch of things happening in those statements, but you see the element of the self-inflicted wound because the Trump administration immediately started backing off his position as quickly as they could. But these are self-inflicted wounds that continue. It's a continual thread with the Trump administration where you're seeing them not really understanding the constituency that actually helped them get elected. When you look at the average salary of a federal employee, Illinois, you know, you're in the 80,000 range, but you look in some of the other states, Wyoming, when you start getting into $60,000, it's not like they can just get a fast loan, especially with a federal government where you don't know if they're going to close down again. Let's just take it from the folks that are actually making the loan, not a bank, but a short-term loan from a payday or something like that, are going to say, you're a federal government employee? Are we sure we want to make a deal with
you? Is there a real guarantee here?
Yeah, so I think the optics are well wrong, and I think they also forget the issue of urgency. I mean, folks that are trying to pay their rent or pay off a mortgage or pay their credit cards, you know, people are paycheck to paycheck as it is, and to lose two paychecks in that pay range, it's very tough. Savings, folks don't save anymore the way they used to.
Well, like I said, you know, given the polling on this and the fact that you know, the president's position was not supported in a great deal of support. But as I said earlier, I think it was the issue, like on when hearing about LaGuardia was basically shutting down.
Yeah, when his friends are calling up, going, "What the heck?" You know, it's a real problem.
Well, but just even furthering the fact that when you're impacting, you know, air travel to such a great degree. Of course, already you had the fact that you had concourses closed at airports because of TSA workers that were not getting paid, not showing up for work. And then you throw in, you know, control tower folks. I mean, they don't have anything else on their minds, right?
Well, you even saw, I mean, it's amazing the constituency work that you saw trade associations go through. And, you know, not just the realtors who I represent, but other groups saying, you know, the FDA not having inspectors. So those that are, you know, that eat organic or vegetarian, there's no one watching the food supply anymore. I mean, you start getting those narratives, people start going, you know, the government actually is involved in an awful lot of things that we may not feel that they're involved in, but actually help to secure our daily ways of life.
Now, granted, you know, we look at things differently than people in other parts of the country because of we're in Chicago, we're in Illinois. But part of me, and I had Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman, on a few weeks ago during the early days of this shutdown, and I told him off the air, it's like, did the president bother to look at what happened in Illinois when we went 2 years without a state budget over a battle of ideological wills that also, you know, in this case, now you have a Democratic U.S. House, you have a Democratic legislature in Illinois, a Republican president, a Republican governor. But, you know, look at what happened after 2 years without a budget in the state of Illinois, something that will take, you know, easily a decade to try to figure out where the direction of the state's going when it comes to things like social services, higher education, those kinds of things. The impacts, everybody talks about the quick impact of federal workers, contractors, that. But there are lasting impacts, too, just like the fact of who wants to be a federal worker necessarily these days.
Well, maybe the president got tired of winning. But the reality is, when you start looking at White House structure or any of those the higher levels, you have careerists and then you have the politicos. You have careerists and politicos. And the careerists, you have to know that the careerists, the people that are really the entrenched bureaucrats, have to be advising them that they're aware of what was going on in Illinois, what was going on in other places, and that this does not work. It just seems that the politicos on those teams are so dogged to make sure that the president's actions and optics really don't coincide, but that there's something happening that show him taking some kind of point or leadership, that they're forgetting the mechanics of government altogether.
Well, I just don't know that, you know, by February 15th, we're going to be in a different position.
No, I don't. You know, I think there's a, you know, no one's, if no one's looking for a middle in this thing, it could be very clear that they're going to close down the government again February 15th, which, you know, again, if you're a mom or dad that's a federal, you know, a federal penitentiary worker or guard or a TSA person, you know, you're not just looking at how you're going to survive this, but you're probably looking for how do I get out of this job that I thought was going to be fairly secure and that I was very good at.
And we are kind of at that tipping point, too, where, you know, you've got candidates announcing for 2020 already. We're in that everything gets so framed by the politics rather than the pragmatism.
Well, it's also the issue of competency, though, too. I mean, we've got a lot of candidates that are jumping into this thing that aren't really the standard bearers of the Democratic Party. And arguably, I mean, we also saw some strange action from the RNC, that the RNC actually went through the motions of saying that they aren't going to allow a primary
right.
to happen.
He's
for
our
President
guy.
Trump
is our,
you know,
guy.
And that doesn't preempt guys like Kasich or others from running, but it's really starting to send a signal that this is where we're going to go, this is how we intend to go. And the president's going to, it's going to be interesting to see how this president frames what came out of this whole shutdown. I can see this guy going out basically saying, you know, did you guys feel the government shutdown with the federal government? You know, I didn't feel it. None of us really felt it. It shows that the federal government's bloated and all these other things. And it'll be interesting to see how federal workers react to that kind of rhetoric that's coming out. I mean, the FBI took the pounding the first 2 years, but I think you're going to see all federal government employees feel that same kind of pressure.
And they can be very vocal.
Without a doubt. And remember, some of them are also part of organized labor.
Yes, indeed. That's Brian Bernardoni, Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy at the Chicago Association of Realtors. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by my good friend Brian Bernardoni.
Well, he had to be pulled off his phone because Doc Emmerich is texting him. Must be nice.
Well, he appreciated my thoughts on the NHL All-Star game. That's all.
I mean, to have a friend like Doc Emmerich is pretty cool.
It is.
And he's a Svengoolie fan. I mean, he plugs him like I do.
Yes. Well, what's not to like about Svengoolie?
Of course.
Absolutely. let's shift gears from the federal scene here to all the activity going on in the mayor's race in Chicago. We're now 14 candidates. Early voting starts Tuesday. We were talking earlier about the TV ads kind of ramping up. And we, as I mentioned, you know, about political campaigns, sometimes they're affected by things that the candidates have no effect over. And I think we've definitely been seeing that with the fallout from Ed Burke.
What's been startling is if you look across the sphere of the polls that are taking place, clearly President Preckwinkle has been hit pretty hard by these numbers. I mean, her numbers have dropped at an alarming rate, I think, from a political campaign perspective, an alarming rate. And also, Susana Mendoza's numbers haven't been helped much by it. But you're also starting to see where there are ceilings on numbers, like for former chief of staff and Commerce Secretary Daley's numbers. You see that he's hit a ceiling. What's surprised me are the numbers that are growing for Gary Chico. I mean, Chico's numbers were in the 1 to 2%, and now he's in the 9 to 11%. And numbers for around Willie Wilson and things like that, where you're starting to see some numbers. You're starting to see the field close in, and you're starting to see where the second-tier numbers just aren't seeing any growth. We've got four or five weeks left in this campaign, though, and that's an eternity in a race like this. We're starting to see almost a scandal a week.
Well, I was going to say, we could, you know, ostensibly see, you know, other shoes dropping in, you know, fallout from the Burke investigation. And you know, where do those have an effect? You mentioned about Willie Wilson, who got 10% 4 years ago. Now with Dorothy Brown off the ballot, you know, she does have a sizable, not, I don't know necessarily significant, but a sizable.
No, I would, you know, Dorothy Brown's numbers have always been the ones that have impressed me the most, and the ones I think from a campaign side concern me the most, because she doesn't have to spend, she never had to spend a lot of money to get the numbers that she did. She had has a very strong base amongst evangelical African Americans in the South and West Side, and she can get the base out. So
it's the church ladies.
Yeah, and you know, these are the Wednesday Sunday church ladies.
Yes.
This is a different kind of group, and Dorothy Brown is still going to be able to weigh in pretty considerably on these numbers. And you know, we can toss around a number like you know, Chico at 11 or 12, or Wilson at 9 or 10, or whatever number he's sitting at today, depending on the poll. Remember, you might need only 12 or 13% to get into that second slot. So those numbers, those constituencies matter. It's going to be the ability of the mayoral campaigns to start identifying who their pluses and minuses are, and to really start driving out vote as soon as possible.
Well, obviously, GOTV, get out the vote, is always critical in any election. I just wonder, yeah, it costs a lot of money. And who, you know, people look at TV and that kind of thing, but the real rubber meets the road is getting people to turn out.
And that's what excites me in part with what I'm seeing with the Chico campaign. I mean, they've got five campaign offices across the city. They're running things both from a citywide perspective and in a ground game. But, you know, in that, I mentioned that. Let's remember, the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party is running for mayor. That gives her an immediate base of volunteers and people that are going to be able to churn out the vote as well. So I've told close friends this, and I see it this way. To start really forecasting who's going to win this mayor's race at this point, 5 weeks sounds like a short amount of time, but it's an eternity in this game. We're probably around opening day in a baseball season, so we can't decide who's going to be the World Series champ based on it. But you're starting to see what that field really looks like, and it's about a four or five person field. But there is a lot of weight on some of the front runners that's going to be really hard to shake.
Well, and although we've seen it kind of through the issue of Burke and the federal criminal complaint against him, where we've seen some of the firepower going to criticize, obviously, Tony Preckwinkle, but also Susana Mendoza, and to some extent even Bill Daley. I don't know that we've really seen the hard, hard negative attacks yet.
First off, when we talk about this Burke fallout, I think Ed Burke still has an opportunity to win this race. If you go into the 14th ward, the streets are paved, the streets are clean, sidewalks are in good shape, you don't see potholes. From a ward-specific aspect, he's been a good alderman. It would not shock or surprise me if Ed Burke pulls this thing off. He's a fighter at the end of the day. If you go back in history, Richard J. Daley would always say an indictment is an indication of guilt. But we don't know the full depth of all of this stuff yet.
Correct.
You've got 2 years of audio tapes that Alderman Solis was involved in, a long record of phone calls that Alderman Burke was involved in, allegedly, for both of them. So and it's hard to frame those issues in 5 weeks, you know, but the hits keep coming. I think the op research files are opening up. I mean, you know,
files are getting tossed over the transom.
Yeah, and in that being said, you're seeing some of the what a lot of us thought were big talent within the Democratic Party really being shot down between either self-inflicted wounds on their own part, or really being shot down by other candidates. I mean, this is, again, go back to the basics of Chicago politics. This is going to be a ward by ward, block by block battle. A lot of the energy from these campaigns are going to be stemmed from aldermanic races, and we've got hot races all over the city of Chicago that are going to drive out vote. And it's going to be the ability, the mayoral candidates that are going to make it to the runoff are the ones that are going to have good field, good organization, top issue people, and understand the actual mechanics of the city. And I think that field narrows down very quickly. I think Chicago voters are smart enough to realize that they cannot risk the running of the city with someone who does not understand how it works.
Speaking of how things works, we also had a vote by the Chicago Planning Commission on the massive Lincoln Yards development, the former Finkel Steel site, one of the largest ever planned developments in the city's history. And still a lot of concern, a lot of community concern, claiming that this was being rushed through. Alderman Brian Hopkins says, no, this has gone through several revisions. The plans for a 20,000-seat soccer arena and an entertainment complex were excised from it, that there's alternatives that were put into this, questions about land use, questions about vertical, a lot of questions, and how this blends into the neighborhood.
So there are a lot of things at stake in this Lincoln Yards deal. You know, I'll put it on the record. I support Lincoln Yards. I think it's what's needed. We need to build more density. We need to look at issues of creating more housing units, because some of these things are everybody wins scenarios. When you start building buildings, organized labor has a great role. You have, you know, probably more than 3,500 construction jobs out there. Those are good, high-paying jobs that are going to help really take a part of the city that could have easily fallen off the face of the earth in some ways.
Very easily.
And really change some things. But I think while we're all getting excited about the fight and all excited about the issues of aldermanic prerogative, you know, I have the honor of running a community for a while, and I know what big development looks like. And the idea that aldermen want to just willy-nilly give up aldermanic prerogative, it's going to be interesting when you get a mayor who wants to build something in your community and you no longer have the aldermanic prerogative to say no. There's a whole series of those kind of things. But getting really down to the nub of Lincoln Yards, the fight, I think, now is one thing. But the fight that's going to happen in a couple of years to decide who's actually going to be the alderman around Lincoln Yards.
Exactly.
The aldermen that are there today may not be the aldermen there tomorrow. And you saw the same kind of fights really around South Shore when we started talking about the other steel.
The
U.S. Steel site, where the shifting of aldermanic maps and aldermanic leadership changed the scope of how those development projects actually look. Look, Lincoln Yards is going to bring density, population, density and population, bring new businesses, bring vitality, work to keep the tax base on an even keel. It's an exciting project. I hope the city council passes it. But I think the bigger fight's going to be this map. I mean, I think a lot of folks are missing the bigger point of what's going on with these aldermanic races. It's all about what this map is going to look like moving forward.
Well, and that's a very good point. And because, you know, this is not like Lincoln Yards is going to be built tomorrow. I mean, it's going to be an evolving project. And as Alderman Hopkins said, you know, you're looking at a 10 years of development, each one kind of as a phase kind of thing, so that there will be some give and take here. And I also, you know, I from the development side, you know, I don't know how you can make hard, specific commitments on a project of that size, on certain things like, well, we're going to have various entertainment hubs or retail hubs. But until you see how kind of the thing works out, it's kind of a floating issue, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be too general about it, but it's almost like looking at the Wrigley Field redevelopment. It happened in phases. Certain things happen.
There's an evolution.
There's some give and take in what those things look like, and then you come up with what will potentially be the best deal possible. Alderman Hopkins has been, I think, very forthright about his approach in getting this thing done. He's had to carry an awful lot of weight, as well as through the mayor's leadership, to get this thing done and get it done now. There's a lot of jobs at stake here. I mean, the cranes that the mayor talked about for the last couple of years, these guys are going to need a lot more work, and this is the perfect kind of project to get that done. Any good alderman is going to know what that give and take looks like, and they're going to be able to do it through phasing. And I think, again, this is a very smart project. It's a good project for the city, a lot of folks are fearful of change, but this is a good change for a part of the city that could actually use it.
That's Brian Bernadoni, Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy for the Chicago Association of Realtors. And Brian will be hanging on for the rest of the show to help out this recovering shoulder replacement surgery treatment victim that I am. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this sunny but cold Sunday morning, the last Sunday of January in Chicago for 2019. Joining me here in studio is my good friend Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors, as he helps me as I guess this is my first rehab show.
You look like you're at fighting weight and ready to go, and that first hour went by real well. It saw no pain. You look real good. Plus, again, Doc Emmer keeps giving you all those good vibes. I think my path to success, I think the Mark Hamill liked a tweet of mine on Twitter once. I mean, that's not Doc Emmer.
No. Come on. cut it out. Joining me on the phone now is Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. And as I said earlier, Senator has been a leader on veterans' rights issues in the Illinois General Assembly. And, Senator, I thought it'd be an appropriate time to have you on. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. Glad to hear the shoulder's doing better.
And a big win for Willowbrook basketball last night, I believe.
Big win for, well, actually, the last week has been very good for Willowbrook basketball.
I'm glad to hear that.
Big win for us against Oswego. Big win against Addison Trail as well.
Well, anytime you beat Addison Trail, it's perfect. So, I'm sorry. We're talking like two Villa Park homers here. I'm sorry about that, folks. Senator, I wanted to talk to you because, you know, obviously we went through this whole issue of the cases of Legionnaires' disease and the outbreaks, repeated outbreaks at the Quincy Veterans Home, the post-Civil War era Veterans Home, and, you know, we're building a new one, which really seemed like that was really from the beginning the only real option given the age of that facility. But then we learned just a few days ago that there was a case of Legionnaires at the Mantino Veterans Home. I'm not so familiar with that facility, and you know, yes, Legionnaires does occur in facilities like that, nursing homes, other things like that. What do you know about what's going on there and what the state's reaction is to that?
Well, I will say that I'm glad we are responding a lot faster than in prior years. You know, when this case was found, it was made notice. Notice was made to the public. Steps are now being taken to address. They've already put filters on. This isn't like the Quincy home where, you know, everything was sort of hidden for a while, and staff didn't know. This was immediately responded to and addressed. So I like the steps taken forward, and some of that had to do with our legislation that we passed last year in response to the Quincy Veterans Home and the fact that everything was sort of being hidden and pushed away. And remember, there was, what, a seven-day lag time in between the first case and when they actually started telling people what was going on. This is starting to be pushed and addressed right away. Now, what the final solution is going to be in Manteno, we're probably going to have to wait a little bit to get what they're going to be moving forward with, but filters are already out there. Staff has already been notified. They're taking safety precautions that should have been taken at Quincy immediately when the Legionnaires was found to have broken out, but they didn't take those immediate steps. So what we're seeing is there's an immediate response to it, and hopefully there's going to be an immediate response as to whether or not we start going after the pipes, where they could centralize where it came from, and start investigating that right away.
Well, and I think that was the thing that was so frustrating about Quincy, was that the response didn't necessarily appear, the initial response didn't appear to be a health-driven response as much as a bureaucratic response.
Well, the response initially the first time in Quincy was more a mitigation response, and not a mitigation of the Legionnaires, but a mitigation of not letting any negative news come out of the government and not letting any negative news come out of the governor's office. This time it's been thoroughly put out there that it's going on, and it's, you know, we're showing, the governor's office is showing what steps they're starting to take, where, like I said, immediately they've already said we've started to put filters on. They're not hiding and covering up what's happening, which I think is a good thing for transparency. It's a good thing to get out there. It's a terrible thing that it's actually happening at the veterans' home, and we need to address it, figure out how to stop it. But the initial reaction is far separate and far different than what happened 4 years ago at the Quincy home.
Well, anytime when you're forced to try to submit Freedom of Information request for emails, that's never a good thing.
And when you have public hearings to investigate, and it entirely contradicts what you end up finding out in emails, that's a horrible thing as well.
Brian Bernadone has a question for you, Senator.
First off, sir. Senator, thank you for your service. It's a tremendous responsibility that you're taking on. You had the pleasure of serving on Governor Pritzker's task force on Veterans Affairs. What other priorities are you looking for beyond your incredible work on this Legionnaires issue?
So I think one of the biggest priorities we're going to find, and it's truly a priority not only just for veterans but for everybody, is job creation and job skills training. Look, when I went into the military, I was an infantry soldier. When you come out as an infantry soldier into the real world, it's your skill set is not necessarily leading you into a computer science degree. So trying to find ways that we can increase job skills training for veterans when they come out is going to be a huge one. And then more coordination, obviously, with healthcare from the federal Department of Defense. Myself and Representative Stephanie Kivowit did a whole sort of task force, I want to say 3.5 years ago, to deal with veteran suicide. So acclimating people and transitioning our veterans back into home life, getting them jobs, getting them opportunity, finding them housing, are all big things that we want to work on with their incoming governor.
You know, one of the things when it comes to Veterans Affairs, but also in other issues, kind of like child care, those kinds of things, where
we have
several programs that are potentially available, but that there is no kind of streamlining or comprehensive oversight to make sure that there's delivery of services. And I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, with Veterans Affairs, you know, it of course is its own agency, but at the same time, you know, you do have various other social programs that are operated through other social agencies, state agencies, you know, how much integration is there in trying to make sure that this networking is there, that services are available?
Well, this is something that's going to have to go on, not only with veterans, but with every agency across the board. And the governor has said he wants to remedy that situation where everybody acts in their own silo and nobody changes lanes, to where everybody sort of works together and pulls in the same direction. And if, as you said, look, veterans are qualified for some of the child care, but they may not know that they have to go through a different department. If we could start streamlining all that, whether it be through upgraded and integrated technology or whether it be just through better cooperation. I know that, pardon me, the governor has four deputy governors now who are part of their responsibility is making sure these agencies all work together and all sort of come together for one goal and one plan to deliver a better service model for the residents of the state of Illinois, whether that be veterans, whether that be municipal officials, however it has to work. We need to start integrating so that everybody comes together and we're sort of pulling all in the same direction and nobody's pulling off in different avenues.
Along those lines, Senator, back in 1996, I worked on President Clinton's campaign on veterans issues and worked with Jim Balser and others who I'm sure you're acutely aware of on different kinds of consolidation, not only on the veterans groups that were government, but also veterans groups that were veterans organizations that were all over the place, working sometimes on the same issue, but different organizations all together. Are you still seeing that trend line from 1996 to 2018, that there are a lot of veteran service organizations with a lot of young, aggressively excited people that want to serve, but there's still a lack of coordination amongst those groups?
Well, there definitely is a lot of groups that come out to help veterans. Look, you have running clubs that'll have 30, 40 veterans in them. Part of what we found in the Suicide Task Force is as veterans leave the military, one of the main things that's missing from their lives is a structure of sort of a group mentality where there's somebody in charge and orders come down and you fulfill your job and your responsibility, which is why a lot of different organizations come out and people become part of that. Now, if those groups can coordinate with us, that'll make life a whole lot easier and we can get more help to the people who need it more frequently.
Well, from the housing standpoint, just know that the Illinois Realtors stand with you on helping to house veterans in any way we can.
Illinois Realtors are a great group and a great organization, so thank you for that.
We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune with my good friend Brian Bernadone from the Realtors. And we're speaking with Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. We've been talking about Veterans Affairs issues, and I know that the new governor, J.B. Pritzker, has spent much of his early tenure signing executive orders on various issues, on things that he campaigned about, including veterans treatment. And I'm not exactly, you know, the executive order is not necessarily law, as it were, but it certainly outlines the policies that an administration intends to pursue. I'm not exactly sure what was all contained in the nitty-gritty of the executive order regarding veterans, and maybe you can help shed some light there.
So the initial thing that the governor has committed to immediately is to assess and evaluate and take recommendations on how we can better utilize the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I don't think we've had that in probably many years as far as, you know, besides just putting in a director and saying go. You know, and whenever you just put in a director and just sort of give them, here you go, you're hoping that they come up with the solutions that are necessary. But the executive order really is going to force the Department of Veterans Affairs to move forward and do a comprehensive review of what they're actually accomplishing on their day-to-day goals, what they're actually accomplishing in their long-term, plus any weaknesses that are available or sitting within the department, and how we can address those to strengthen those, whether that be our conversation and communication with the Department of Defense. Are we finding out who the veterans are that are coming home, that are coming back from heavy combat areas? Are we making sure that, as we said earlier in the conversation, are we making sure that veterans know all the services that are available to them? How are we getting that information to them? How are we communicating with them? How are we actually structuring all of our different agencies to line up to fulfill the mission that we have in Illinois to make sure veterans are successful from when they get home?
What about the Chicago Veterans Home?
The Chicago Veterans Home, they're still in the process of building. It was a shame that this is something that should have been open probably last year. But once all the grant money was stopped via executive order back in 2015, construction on that building stopped entirely. And then they found out after 2 years when they were starting to reopen it that they had structurally done something incorrect. So it was like they almost had to start from scratch.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. More importantly, that's a lot of time. That's a lot of time. That's something we're in 2019. This had been started under the Quinn administration, and it was stopped under the Rauner administration and had to be restarted. And that's a lot of time. That's a lot of time that had a significant amount of beds. I believe it's 200 beds that could have been open right now for veterans.
Working with the new governor, how would you define the mood that you see in a governor now who's taking a lot of action aggressively? Have you seen a change in the environment down in Springfield as a result of this new governor? How would you quantify it?
I would tell you it's nice to have a positive person at the top of the chain. For 4 years we've heard our top sort of commander in chief of Illinois beat up Illinois, tell everybody how terrible Illinois was until 5 months before this most recent campaign. So it was a constant berating of Illinois. It was a constant tear down of Illinois. It was, I don't know if you recall when the comments were made that people around the Champaign-Urbana area, they just don't have intelligent people to work there. We have one of the top tier universities. So it's nice to see a cheerleader for Illinois and somebody who appreciates and understands all the great things we have in Illinois instead of trying to score political points by tearing everything down.
We were talking about the problems with the Chicago Veterans Home, but that involves issues of capital and capital construction.
Right.
And obviously that's something that everybody is pointing to as a desperately needed thing coming out of Springfield, is a new infrastructure, new roads, bridges, repairs, and it's not just roads. I mean, it is, public buildings, those kinds of things. And while everybody points at it and says, yeah, we need it, there's diversion, different ideas on how to fund it. And also, I kind of question, too, whether, well, this is something people would like to see, enacted right away, if this isn't one of those things that becomes part of the end-of-session May bargaining, when various projects in individual districts can be leveraged for votes on other things.
Well, I think the hardest part you're going to see with the Capitol bill is we have to address how it's going to be funded. I know you've had the leaders of the other caucuses on your show, and they've all agreed and said that they want to see a capital bill. Even downstate members want to see a capital bill. However, the structure of how to pay for it hasn't come forward yet, and hasn't been. You've heard probably the exact same rumors I have. So I'm not necessarily sure where the capital bill is going to be going, especially when there is no concrete plan, no pun intended, on how to pay for it.
You had to go there, didn't you? No asphalt plan, right.
No asphalt plan, no concrete plan. I mean, but that's a real case. Look, it's a great thing to say. Governor Rauner said it for 3 years. I'm going to get a capital plan. but he never pushed how he was going to address it, how he was going to move it forward, how he was going to pay for it. He just kept saying he wanted it to appease certain voter bases. And while everybody's talking about it now, until you come forward with a way to pay for it, where the public actually gets a chance to speak up on it, you know, it's right now just a goal that everybody has. Paying for it, though, is going to be the biggest piece of the puzzle.
That's Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. Senator, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much, Rick. It was a great time.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio with my good friend Brian Bernardoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors. And on the phone for this segment is the Attorney General for the State of Illinois, Kwame Raoul. General, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
I believe that's the first time I've gotten the chance to refer to you as General Raoul.
For you, Rick, it's always just Kwame.
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts.
Take it while you can, General.
Well, right, how about you?
Well, thank you for joining me this morning, and I think we should probably go to the top of the news here because it's something that's been in the news for the last couple of days, and that's about your office, the Attorney General's office, reviewing the sentence that was received by Jason Van Dyke over the killing of Laquan McDonald. Can you tell us what exactly, what is the procedure and what is the legal basis for this review?
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to delve too deep into it for reasons that we haven't even obtained the record of the proceedings, and so it's difficult for me to get too deep into this particular issue because I wasn't witness to you know, every day or any days of the trial and the sentencing proceeding itself. I have read sentencing memoranda. I have read case law that speaks pretty accurately to this situation, and that based on that review and based on review of my staff, the appellate staff within the office, we thought it merited further review of the record, and we have been in touch with the special prosecutor's office, and you know, working in collaboration with them to obtain the record and to review the circumstances of this sentence, which based on case law seemed unusual.
Well, and the issue being of the question under case law, under Illinois Supreme Court, about which is the more significant charge or offense, second degree murder or the aggravated battery counts, the 16 counts there. In the judge's decision, the aggravated counts basically were tossed because of his belief that second degree murder was the more serious crime that occurred, and the sentencing occurred there. Although it would appear that Illinois Supreme Court decisions and case law deem that the aggravated battery count is the more serious. Those are more serious charges. Am I summing that up correctly?
Yeah. I mean, there is a case that does speak to these two specific charges being juxtaposed against one another. In a situation where a court had to make a decision on which was a more serious count to sentence on. Let me say this, Rick. It's, you know, because I've seen how the notion of the Attorney General's office being involved in this being characterized as unusual. To be clear, during Attorney General Lisa Madigan's tenure, First of all, I started my career out as an criminal appellate lawyer in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. At that time, Cook County pretty much handled its appeals all the way up to the Supreme Court or U.S. Supreme Court if the occurrence dictated so.
Cook County on its own would do
that. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Since such time, the Attorney General's office has, in the interest of keeping sort of a uniform approach to what type of case law is created by appeals to the Supreme Court, the Attorney General's office has asserted itself in criminal appeals from throughout the state. Because what may arise out of Cook County or Vermilion County or, wide variety, any one of the 102 counties taken up to the Supreme Court has impact beyond that, just that county of origin, because it impacts law for the entire state. So it is not at all unusual for the Attorney General to be engaged in these sort of matters that would go to the Supreme Court. With regards to writs of mandamus, specifically, there were three occasions last year. So the characterization of the Attorney General's office being engaged in reviewing such a case is just inaccurate on its face. Secondly, I want to just say one thing. I want to applaud the special prosecutor for his willingness to take on the case in the first place. And we have got to go back to the origin of the case where the judge called around to different prosecutors outside of Cook County to see who would be willing to step up, and Joe McMahon was willing to step up. It was no small decision to make. So I applaud him for, one, taking on the case and doing a good job.
Obviously, you know, we're still in that, you know, the fallout of that sentence. But I guess I'm curious, and you mentioned there were three times seeking writ of mandamus. But I mean, is it routine for the Attorney General's office to look at criminal sentencing, or is it something that gets flagged to the Attorney General's office?
Each individual circumstance is different. You know, most of the cases that go up in appeal are, you know, defendants' appeals.
Right. So, that's what I mean. It's somewhat unique here because it's not, indeed, you don't have really a defendant's appeal going on.
Right. But it's not unique that the AG's office is involved, right? The AG's office is going to be involved regardless if it's a matter that's being considered.
Sure, uniformity and that kind of thing.
Right. So, you know, I've seen characterization of our office's involvement as unusual on that basis, which is just totally inaccurate. You know, questioning what standing the Attorney General's office has, and that's just off.
General, you've been in office for a couple weeks now. What other areas of advocacy do you see yourself pursuing now that you've actually got the full mantle of the office around you?
Well, you know, the Attorney General's office has a wide reach, and I've been, you know, I knew it ahead of time, but I didn't know it to the extent that I know it now. after 2 weeks.
Welcome to the job.
Yeah. 2 weeks, that seems like 2 years, because, you know, first of all, you know, I've got to really applaud Lisa Madigan for recruiting and retaining a group of lawyers that are real superior lawyers who are undercompensated, not only as compared to private sector lawyers with their type of experience, their type of pedigree, but compared to other public sector lawyers of lawyers. And you know, we've got a really high quality staff in all across the office. But to answer your question, we're involved in both criminal and civil appeals. We've got a general law section that government represents law cases where we're defending the state. We're involved in child welfare cases, workers' comp cases. We've got an environmental section. We've got a public interest section that does anything from civil rights, antitrust, to some of the what you would characterize as the Trump multi-state involved litigation against some of the odd positions that the federal government has been taking. There's a consumer protection division. We have got a criminal enforcement division where we go in to the counties at the invitation of county state's attorneys to help prosecute cases. We have a crime victim services component of the office, and we've got legislative advocacy, legislative affairs, and so it's very broad in its nature. There's also the public access office that's often spoken about, where we deal with FOIA and Open Meeting Act complaints of local governments or state government agencies. I probably haven't touched everything.
So that's just day one. Day two is...
It's quite broad. Day one, I got sworn in on the 14th, and I think, on the 15th, we had maybe two or three cases that we were arguing before the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, involving at least one criminal sentencing matter. So that speaks to the question of how unusual the Attorney General's office is to be in the Supreme Court. Day two of my job, we were arguing in the Supreme Court about a sentencing matter. Day three, we were in the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome
to the hot seat.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Kwame Raoul, the Attorney General of the state of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by my good friend Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors, and we're speaking to the Attorney General for the state of Illinois, Kwame Raoul. And, General, you touched on some of the office duties that, the vast various departments within the Attorney General's office. You touched on the one that deals with FOIA. The Freedom of Information Act, an open meetings request. And I guess there's still some question about, the office issues rulings about whether a governmental body is living up to the requirements of the law. But I guess there's still some question about what's the follow-up to that. And obviously, this is an office where it's become even more inundated by, requests to decide whether a government body acted properly in withholding information from a FOIA request, or whether it met in the specified rules of the Open Meetings Act. I'm just kind of wondering, where do you see the AG's office on that going forward?
Well, one of the things I started out with is talking about the compensation of attorneys. The other element of the office is that these lawyers are working hard, undercompensated, and understaffed, and the public access counselors. Public access division is one such division. The great lawyers there doing great work, even people who've been critical of the circumstance recognize that we've got a great staff that work hard on the voluminous cases, and so I do see it as my responsibility to increase the staff there to work through the cases that have grown year after year. I actually sponsored the legislation to create the division within the Attorney General's office years ago. Since that time, we would have never imagined the volume of FOIA and Open Meeting Act complaints that have gone through the office. So, you know, the staffing level that General Madigan put in place, you know, was put in place not knowing that the volume would grow as much as it has year after year.
General,
so,
General,
we're going to deal with that.
Excuse me, General. General, do you think there's enough training of local governments, park districts, other things along that line on FOIA? It's not a matter just of the complaints coming in, but making sure that those who are serving in government understand that FOIA is there and that there's a responsibility on their end. Do you think there's enough training at that level?
What I will say is that there certainly can always be more. I think, and I think our office can serve in a function to be proactive instead of just being reactive, and they have. I have spoken to the staff in that division, and we have spoken about thinking about how we can be more proactive in order to get particularly some. Because some government agencies are better than others. Some municipalities are better than others, and then there's some bad actors. And so if, you know, we could start by identifying those who have a lot of claims that are deemed to be legitimate claims of FOIA denials or Open Meeting Act complaints that where the government entity didn't follow the law, that we could be more proactive in providing guidance ahead of time to how they should handle such requests.
I noticed a couple of times in this conversation you've referred to undercompensated attorneys in your office.
You know, I'm using your show as an opportunity to appeal to my old colleagues. In a general assembly, you know, we've been flat by in terms of appropriations since the mid '90s. The Attorney General's office brings in $32 for every dollar we spend to the state.
So maybe you should have a percentage of recovery goes back to the Attorney General's office.
Well, we can discuss all sorts of possibilities. But
unfortunately, I'm not in a position to negotiate that.
Are we in a negotiation now? Here we go.
You know, your previous guest might be able to help me out in this matter. But seriously, I think it's important to recognize the role that this office plays to the state in terms of keeping our air and water safe from polluters and in terms of protecting consumers from folks who would take advantage of them, in terms of protecting the state at large, in terms of its engagement in criminal matters, and the nature of staff that we have is a superior staff, but we're always victim of poaching because we don't compensate them at a level that would allow us to keep them more long term.
That's Attorney General Kwame Raoul, Attorney General for the State of Illinois. General, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
I appreciate you.
We'll be back with more right after this.